we are back with episode 650 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Wait, it's 650? Another of those milestones? And, I'm completely not prepared.
This is Gary from Jacksonville. And geez, that really snuck up on me. I didn't think we were at 650 already. Have we really talked about that much stuff?
Sweet heavens.
Yes, we have. And in fact, we have feedback from some of what we've said recently. So I guess we've had not only that got a lot of stuff that we've talked about, but we've got people who are listening to it, which is nice. So,
wow.
Yeah, I know. So we are going to go through some of that feedback in this particular episode. And then there are a couple open topics I'm sure that we are going to get into. But before we do any of that, just a general spoiler warning there, Evan.
Certainly. We'll talk about things you might not have seen, you might not have heard. So if you haven't, you'll be spoiled.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Which, you know, since we do have feedback, you never know exactly what we're going to get into. So here we are. All right. Let's go ahead then and start on some comments that came from our friend S. Elliot Fisher. And this goes back to the 12th of January, where he says, regarding show number 633, Edmund, I wouldn't worry about snow consistency in the next season of The Americans. They film a good portion of their show here in my hometown of Staten Island, and they conducted next season's location shoot here throughout October and November. I can assure you we had no snow. However, thanks to climate change, you may see extras in t-shirts and shorts walking past jack-o'-lanterns. It's funny, though, that you would mention the lack of respect their production gets, considering the lack of respect they give my community. At any given time throughout the year, there's up to a dozen film and or different film and television programs being filmed here. You wouldn't know it, though, until you see a local neighborhood portrayed on the finished product. All of the different productions companies are quick, quiet, and polite when working here, except for one. Their Americans production team is the worst I've ever encountered. They block roads they don't have permits to use. They never direct traffic around their sets. They often work during rush hour. They take up spaces meant for paying customers at local businesses, and they never clean up after themselves. I always know when the Americans are in town by the ever-growing cry of frustration by my neighbors, friends, and family on Facebook. I'm sorry, Edmund. I may be a child of the 90s or an 80s, but I look forward to the day the Americans goes the way of the Berlin Wall.
Oh. Wow.
Oh.
Wow, that's a great feedback.
Yeah, like, no, well, I obviously kind of cannot speak for the production, but I'm very sorry to hear that. Not only do you have the chip on your shoulder that I know most Staten Islanders do have is for sort of feeling like the forgotten borough, but to be so horribly treated and dissed, does not reflect well on a production that I do so love. But it is good to hear that. I don't need to be worrying about snow levels, but that's not cleaning up after themselves is just unconscionable, since it is the 650th episode, I will of course use that as my cue to contrast that with all the wonderful things I've heard about the Person of Interest shooting crews as they make their way around the five bars.
Yeah. There's one I can think of, shooting crews, that should be working a lot longer than they're probably going to be. Just saying.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, also coming from our friend is this comment regarding... I'm sorry. I'm on the wrong page. You see, we're so well-oiled machine here that I am messing up right now. There we are. Okay, so this one comes for show 637. While I'm definitely enjoying Supergirl as a whole, I was disappointed with the physical appearance of Red Tornado. Mm. The effects for the character were surprisingly bad in a year that gave us visually stunning Vision in Avengers Age of Ultron, as well as really great portrayals of Gorilla Grodd and King Shark on The Flash. Honestly, by comparison, the Red Tornado costume came across as a soccer mom's homemade quick fix for a young trick-or-treater in something made by a big network production company in the 21st century. He is on a roll.
Yes, indeed.
Oh, geez, I'd love to have him write some stuff. He's good. Anyway, go ahead.
Yes. Well, no, that's what he said about this one in particular. So, Gary, you're our resident DC guy. What did you think of the appearance of Red Tornado?
Well, I agree it was sort of clunky and awkward, but I think that's sort of what they were intending to go for. They weren't trying to show that he was necessarily a smooth oil machine. He was being put together rather, maybe not quickly, but with haste to combat Kryptonians. Think about it now. While we've had Superman, who's been a stirring example, Supergirl really has not been out in the limelight for that long, and now we have all these other people from Fort Roz coming all around. Who knows what's going to happen? I imagine General Lane is scrambling to build anything he possibly can that might have a chance of even delaying or holding back Kryptonians. So I get the sense that that Red Tornado is really sort of maybe not quite hacked together, but by no means version 3 or version 4 at this point. So I agree it was an abysmal costume, but at the same time, I have a sense that is supposed to be a rough, crude machine that they were trying to build to face Kryptonians in a quick manner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wasn't all that upset by it. I felt like, again, it was maybe meant to be a prototype type of thing, and that it was kind of requisitely cheesy as a result, but there we are. I know, though, that even from just the very first production stills for that particular character, there were a lot of people that were waiting for the opportunity to bash it. So, and everybody said, just wait until it's on the actual episode and you can see it in action, and it didn't necessarily change much, but... Edmund, any thoughts on this one, or are you pretty much in agreement?
I'm in agreement, and I think was kind of coming to the same conclusion as Gary that the intent anyway was to try and show that this was just a crude piece that had been thrown together, and certainly the way it malfunctioned was reflecting that as well. But I think they maybe went a little too crude in the way they were depicting it.
And just as a side note for people who actually can go back to I won't say the original Red Tornado because there is one during World War II, but from the Android Robot Tornado's first appearance, he was a very crude, angular-faced, rectangle for eyes type of creation that was quite boxy and sort of looked like somebody had basically built a man figure out of sort of blocks to some extent. So I as I look at the TV show, it harkens back to the original first appearance of Red Tornado. It wouldn't surprise me if we do manage to see him a little bit more streamlined should he come appear again in the series at some point.
Yeah, I guess we'll have to find out. All right. Also, some comments on show 638. He says, I have to say that the more on the offense storyline fall season of Walking Dead, combined with some allusions made by Critical Myth, not having read the source material, has led to a last-minute reprieve to remain on my watch list. I'm not saying the program has ever faltered in quality of script or performance of its actors. This has always been a well-made show. After 5 seasons of the core group constantly suffering without any real gain, it just makes me ask, what's the point? So far, The Walking Dead has covered the post-apocalypse quite well, and now Fear the Walking Dead seems to be covering the apocalypse itself. Now, though, I think it's time to show some legitimate attempt to rebuild society. My hope is Alexandria is that place where humanity's resurrection begins, since it's my understanding that it's managed to continue to endure in the comics. I'm not saying there still shouldn't be a struggle, danger, or loss, but it would be nice to finally have some hope for the main characters and humanity in general. Well... there's hope.
I realize we have spoilers, but at the same time, no, John, don't say those are very keen observations.
Yes, indeed. Those are keen observations. We're not going to say anything other than the fact that even if things do seem to get better, it is going to be a long, hard road to anything remotely like rebuilding society. And I'm sure that we will see that long, hard road in some way, shape, or form going forward, since the show isn't going anywhere anytime soon.
No.
So, no, I think we'll be okay. Let's see now, going on then to some of the other comments. Again, we got a lot, nice amount of feedback recently. So, yes, we got a reminder here that apparently... from 639, Doctor Who, another show that S. Elliott Fisher had on the potential chopping block. But he says it's another show that has narrowly avoided the chopping block for him. In recent years, he's felt unentertained by the program. Honestly, I didn't even watch any of it until the final episode of the season aired. Episodes seem to rely more and more on a Time Lord version of Trekno-babble, along with rapid-fire pacing and gimmicks. Additionally, like Gary, I was disappointed by the complete disregard of the consequences of the Time War. I believe that the Christopher Eccleston episode Dalek is the penultimate story of the revived series. I think he means the... I'm hoping that not penultimate. I'm not sure what the ultimate one then would be. But anyway, the total loneliness of expressed by both the Doctor and the Dalek throughout that episode really portrayed the sorrow of what it meant to be the last of your kind. Since then, though, the Daleks have become more and more an overused villain, and now it seems the Time Lords are heading down the same path. This past season, though, seems to recapture for me some somber Doctor of days past, and there also seems to be more of an acknowledgement of the consequences of the Doctor's actions to the world around him. It's still a series teetering on the edge for me, though hopefully Capaldi will continue to bring some balance to it. So, any thoughts on those particular comments?
Well, I'd certainly agree with him that the wind up of this season and having Capaldi's Doctor go on the warpath against the Time Lords in that finale and especially that whole sort of almost Wild West gunfighter opening, except of course he's a gunfighter without any guns because he doesn't need them. It was certainly bringing that sort of grittier, grimmer attitude back to the Doctor. Even though, of course, given the way it ended, it has kind of left him with a bit of a clean slate. So we will have to see which way things swing once he does return for the next series.
Yeah, that really is true. That it was, in fact, a bit of a clean slate ending there for the season, and I'm very interested to see where this goes, especially if it does turn out to be kind of a final season for Capaldi, although God knows every single season is potentially the end for somebody, so you're never quite sure how long anybody's going to stay in any of the roles on this show. But I've made no bones about the fact that the last two Doctors have been, you know, favorites of mine, and so I feel like the show is perfectly fine right now. This season definitely a step above what was in the previous season, but I think that was partially because we've said this before, the back and forth about whether or not it was in fact Clara's ending kind of hurt last season, as well as the fact that trying to go from the uber importance of Clara to the end of the Matt Smith era to trying to figure out where Capaldi and Clara kind of stood, yeah, that kind of hurt it a little bit, but I do feel as though there was a lot this season that was accomplished in terms of righting the ship, and the fact that at the end of the day, as much as there was a huge arc for Clara, it was definitely meant to inform more the Doctor, and that's the first time in a long time that that's been the case. I think that you'd really need to go back to even the first season with Eleven to have a storyline that seemed to be as clean cut as this season was. So, I mean, think about that, going back to series 5 versus series 9. So a little bit of time since we've had that level of clarity, I think. Anything more on that?
Yeah, I would like to address something, and I'm sort of late to the Whovian parade, so to speak, and I'll defer to your guys' knowledge, but I understand what he's saying. The Time Lords always were sort of this mystical kind of thing where they were set in the past, and we really didn't have much interaction with them. They're invoked when they talk about the Great War and how Gallifrey, you know, is this sort of this place that was destroyed due to the Doctor, or the Doctor had something to do with it. And it always sort of hovered in the background, and it definitely lent this sort of tragicness to the character. Now that we are finding Gallifrey and all the Time Lords are all over the place and changing into different people as they're regenerating right in front of us, it seems like it loses a little bit of its allure or its mystique. And I understand that it's something, oh, we've been talking about it for years, let's go ahead and actually use it type of thing. At the same time, I felt its sort of mystery or ability to the fact that it was gone forever was always, you know, like I said, lent that depth to the Doctor that now it's not quite so much anymore. It kind of reminds me of the argument of, you know, Superman being the last Kryptonian, and now all of a sudden there's Kryptonians, you know, everywhere you sneeze. It takes some sort of the ambience that he's not the last Time Lord anymore, even though I know we have the Master and some other things, but typically that's how he's portrayed, you know, the last of his kind, and that's not the case anymore. And I think he loses something a little bit when people know what, you know, when they know what's behind the curtain, when they know all about TARDISes and, you know, time locks and things of that nature. It loses a little bit of its speciality, I think.
Well, I mean, after 50 years plus of the series, I guess it's going to happen sooner or later. But I know that certainly we've talked about this before. One of the weaknesses, at least I would agree with Steve Moffat and the way that he does things, is that he tries to be overly clever. I think he puts way too much stock in his own ability to be clever, let's put it that way. And yeah, I think that maybe some of the things that you're talking about are Steve Moffat trying to put his mark constantly on the Doctor Who legacy, and at this point, just being the showrunner for a few seasons or series is more than enough. He's already had companions that are of such massive importance that they reorder the universe and the Doctor's entire timeline. It's like, okay. I think what was interesting about this series, 9, was the fact that if you kind of ignore everything that happened between 11 and Clara and just look at Clara as just another companion, it definitely was a more balanced way of approaching it. I see what you mean at the end of the season. I think that the finale, one of the weaknesses of it that was kind of evoked by some of the people who watched it, was the fact that what was the whole point of going back to Gallifrey and to make such a spectacle of him going back to Gallifrey when he's been searching for the planet for a few years now in the background, supposedly, only for it to kind of be almost a way station on the way to something else. He hasn't actually gotten or gone back and stayed for any significant amount of time. And that's even after having taken over the place. and then he leaves right away. So it was a little bit unbalanced in that regard. It's just that there were other things that made it kind of shine as far as I'm concerned. Edmund, how about you? What do you think of those criticisms?
Well, I think certainly in the timeline of the revived Doctor, they certainly made such a point early on of him being of the, you know, that was sort of the big reveal of the return, and Christopher Eccleston's Doctor was there being this great sadness and regret that was permeating his character, and then the discovery that what was the last, and had done these terrible things in the Time War, and there has been a certainly quite a bit of stepping that back and revisionism, and certainly the whole war introduction of the War Doctor, and the whole 50th anniversary special where they really were walking all that back. I can certainly see where particularly people who have come in with the revived version aren't as aware that the Time Lords were perhaps not necessarily on screen all the time, but we're certainly more of a presence in the original run. Certainly, Pertwee's Third Doctor being exiled to Earth by the Time Lords, and in various of the Doctor specials where Gallifrey and the Time Lords were popping up. I can understand somebody taking some of the sort of purity of that original reincarnation and return of the Doctor, and seeing that it's lost a little bit of its sort of power in the way it's been revised, but at the same time that in the 50-year scheme of things is kind of the way it's been with the Doctor, with the way he regenerates, you can always just focus on the incarnations you prefer and keep your focus on those.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good way of looking at it. Who knows? I mean, I know, Gary, that you haven't been particularly thrilled with Capaldi since he started, and so that's two series now that you've kind of been maybe not as particularly pleased with the show. So who knows? Maybe in another year or so you'll be meeting a new Doctor. You don't know. Every year we hear that it's possibly the end for every Doctor that we watch. So,
I think I heard that about Capaldi before he even finished shooting the first season.
Right. So there we are. All right, that's it as far as our feedback goes here on the VOG Network forums. So as always, you can go over there and leave some feedback. And otherwise, you can also leave feedback over on our Facebook page. Plenty of different options as far as that is concerned, but we also have a little bit of time here for any open topics. So, Gary, I was wondering if you had anything that you wanted to discuss.
Well, let's see. I recently finished the latest Harry Dresden novel. I liked it. It's taken me about 20 novels to finally start to see some of the formula to it, but I still enjoy going through the steps to find it out. There was also, from a personal nature, I'm a big Legion of Superheroes fan, and there's been hints that we will see something of the Legion in the Legends of Tomorrow series, and being a time travel series, I would think the Legion would be a great match for it, so I'm not sure if it's going to be something as small as a Legion flight ring, or we get to see the 28-plus Legionnaires all flying through the sky, but whatever it is, they definitely have this Legion fan curiosity piqued, so I'm looking forward to that.
Now, I did want to bring up something that happened in the last couple of weeks, and I know that it's kind of close to you, and that is this whole business with CBS and their battles with the fan production X&R?
Yes. Yes. For the Star Trek. Yeah, and it's an interesting thing, and while people like to just sort of insulate it as this one case, it's really could change the future of Star Trek fan films and maybe fan films in general. To give you a really quick synopsis, Paramount is part of a holding company under Viacom with CBS, and a whole bunch of rights got shuffled around during a corporate reorganization, so CBS controls the rights to Star Trek now. Have they moved? Technically, no, but just somebody got appointed in charge of it. Paramount will still make the movie, continue to make the movies, but CBS is in charge of actually the film rights and the TV rights. Okay, so that being said, they're the final authority on everything Star Trek at this point. Star Trek has had fan films going for, gosh, I think over 20 to 25 years now. People have in their basements or even garages or small warehouses built mock-ups of different sections of the ship, be it the bridge, be it sick bay, hallways, and shot their own films. And while there has never been an official policy by Paramount or CBS on these, they're fully aware that they've been done and have been being done for 20 plus years. And they have a, I don't know if I'd call it a cult following, but a fairly regular following. And these productions put out typically 1 to 2 episode length shows a year. And this has been going on for some time. A man named Alec Peters decided that he too wanted to do a Star Trek fan film. However, he wanted to do it a little bit different, and some of the fan films have followed the same route where it's not actually filming Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, but they want to do some other section of the Star Trek universe, tangentially related in some cases, but still within the Star Trek universe. He wanted to do actually what his idea was to do prior to it. There was a character, Garth of Izar, he was in, I believe it was Day of the Dove? I don't recall this specific TOS episode, but he was in an insane asylum and eventually was cured at the end. This character was mentioned as being required reading at the Academy. He had won the Battle of Axanar, hence the name of the production. Originally it was Star Trek Axanar. They backed off to just call it Axanar to try and trample less on the IP property. And so he said he wanted to do one, but he wanted to do it at professional quality. While he admired many of the fan productions done to date, he really wanted to do something that was actually on par with something you would regularly see on television or perhaps even on the movie screen. He knew this would take money, so he reached out to the fan community. He did a Kickstarter, an Indiegogo campaign, and in the process of acquiring a studio, building all the sets, and getting ready for production, he raised over $1 million. This is a substantial amount of money. Most other fan productions never even reached half of that amount, more or less a quarter of that amount. So it was quite a sort of leap. And it also showed the hunger that so many Star Trek fans had for, I don't want to say real Star Trek might sort of show the camp I'm in, but at the same time where they feel that the current Star Trek movies don't portray the sort of message or the moral sort of tone that Star Trek tries to show, or the the positive things that humanity actually does improve and get better. So they wanted to see that. And so he raised over $1 million, and they were going to begin shooting sometime this month in January of 2016. He has spoken to CBS prior to January of this year. And while they refused for legal purposes to say one thing any way or the other, they by no means dissuaded him, told him to stop, or told him to re-examine what he's doing. And so he went on doing this. CBS and Paramount both have now are now directly suing him. This is different from just the cease and desist order, meaning we don't like what you're doing. Stop it now or else. This actually is, they went right with the or else part. And most people flag this for being because he's raised over $1 million worth of revenue to make this. He still is considering this a fan film production, but he is bringing on professional staff from Hollywood. Hollywood's filled with professionals that aren't always working at the time, so they're glad to both practice their arts, try and improve it, and if they can do something for a project that means something to them, all the better. So he's been hiring on these people for different stage work as well as for acting. And he is paying some of them. And this is another big point of contention that a not-for-profit venture doesn't pay people. I don't know if people have really heard of like the Red Cross or anything, but occasionally, even though a company may not earn profit, they still have to compensate people for their time. And fan productions haven't typically done this type of thing. So again, it's new territory, and it was never against the rules. There have never really been any rules. Yes, you have general IP or intellectual property rights, meaning the idea of Star Trek. But again, people have been shooting these films for 20 plus years. So he didn't see that there was any foul until this came up. So at this point, now as the lawsuit goes through, because as I said, they sort of skipped the cease and desist order, which I found odd. But I'm not a lawyer. Paramount and CBS will probably have to define what a fan film, what parody, and will consist of, and this could actually, sort of decide whether or not we get movies like Spaceballs, or even some other fan films that happen. Like, you see things like that Dark Power Rangers trailer that happened a few months ago, or any of these other Star Trek productions. And so it's might define this whole fan idea in general, if depending on how it's ruled. Now, just as a side note, people might say, oh well, there's other stuff out there. Star Wars under Lucasfilm actually came up with specific hard rules and gave them to people, and their fan film community has been thriving for years. They even run competitions to award people for the best fan films. Star Wars gets more press, and people stay involved in the community. And I really hope that CBS will come forward and sort of embrace that same thing. And fan films are not the enemy. They're not. They can add to your property, not necessarily take away from it. And I hope they see that. Now, in 2017, we supposedly have a new Star Trek major motion picture coming out, as well as talk about them coming out with a television series. Now, do they feel that these various fan films and Axanar in particular will flood the market and hamper their profits? I really don't see that happening. People seem to forget, and it has been a while, but there was a time where Star Trek was fielding two television series running at the same time and a major motion picture and major motion pictures while that was all going on, and they were making a pretty good amount of money. So I don't think a 2-hour movie in the scope of things is really going to destroy the franchise. So it's it hasn't gone to court yet, and there's really not much news out other than the initial responses. So we'll have to wait and see. But it's quite an interesting event and change of events that has been happening.
Yeah, I just don't know why they chose to really, I guess maybe because of the threshold of the money that was being raised, that might have had something to do with it, but it just seems awfully arbitrary. And I feel like it's also maybe kind of shooting themselves in the foot when it comes to this, because really CBS has not been making friends with the fact that they are actively involved in kind of keeping new shows from getting on the air. I know that they're putting the new production on their streaming service next year, I think it is. So there is something that they have in the works, but unless it's directly contradictory, I can't imagine why it needs to be, why Axanar needs to be kind of pushed to the curb or sent this cease and desist. It seems awfully, I don't know, hypocritical.
Well, I agree. And they've sent to the several other Star Trek fan film productions like Star Trek Continues, Star Trek Phase 2, Star Trek Farragut. And, there's a whole bunch of even, sort of smaller endeavored ones, Star Trek Intrepid. And there's a few of them. And they've not sent even a cease and desist letter to anyone else. So I would have to think it's the money. And some people critique Mr. Peters for being a bit bold, but, you know, he's starting something from scratch, and he's basically a Hollywood producer. You expect a meek, mild guy? I mean, I would, you know, I would expect a guy who, you know, knows how to talk to people and is trying to put all sorts of things together to make this happen, and basically for, you know, his love of the series. So I agree that it's, some people say it's the money, some people say it's because of the new Star Trek material coming out from the studios within the next year. But again, this is not a recurring series. They're going to end up with like an hour and a half project at best. And, you know, they continue to make efforts to point out that they are, you know, a private fan production, and that they are not part of, you know, CBS or Paramount. So I'm hoping they can come to some solution. And geez, well, CBS is trying to pretty much move stuff over to their all access private pay website and app. Gosh, you know, Star Trek fan films might be a nice little corner to throw into their all access package for people who want to see it.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately for me, this really does sound like some of CBS's sort of old school thinking just coming to the fore. Certainly, it's the network that's become, while they do very well in the ratings, they've become known for just relying on they're procedural formats, basically, that they just like to sort of cling to and keep playing out. It still amazes me that Blue Bloods and Hawaii Five-O are still hanging on to Friday nights for as many seasons as they have been. And it really feels to me this was a case of some of the executives, seeing more of the amount of money and the production levels that were going into Axanar, and getting the wind up about that and seeing them as competition rather than as synergy and things and something that would just generate more interest in a franchise that has been off the air for a while. And you would think that just encouraging more new blood, especially with the example that has already happened with Lucasfilm and Star Wars, would make more sense. But with the way the lawyers are involved now, it's I'm fearing that this story is going to go more in the other direction. And just in case any of the TOS Uber fans out there, just to keep them from writing in, we know it wasn't Day of the Dove, it was Whom Gods Destroy, with of course Yvonne Craig delightfully slinking around as one of Kirk's multi-hued women.
Yes, indeed. I'm guessing that was season three, where some of the stuff starts to blend together. And
yes, it was. Yes. But it was. I still consider it one of the highlights of season three.
Well, clearly, so do the creators of Axanar.
Yes.
So. I just thought that was an interesting turn of events that was worthy of note, because again, we are getting into this world where I don't know. Fan culture, geek culture has kind of erupted over the last several years. I mean, there's always been a pretty dedicated group of fans out there for the major franchises, and certainly there have been some major productions, fan productions over the years, but it just escalates as time goes by, and certainly this was probably the most ambitious of all of them. And for this to be the way that it kind of, for all their gains and all their you know, they're finally kind of making certain milestones that they needed in order to really make this happen, to kind of get undercut by people who were ostensibly supporting them, is really kind of leaving a bad taste in my mouth. And now CBS is going to have to really step up their game when it comes to the new show that they're putting out, in order to really kind of make me forgive them a little bit on this one. I'm not going to pretend that I'm going to, you know, not watch their new show because of this. Let's face it, we're all going to watch a new show. But it is going to be kind of unfortunate if they leave fans, or major fans, with that bad taste in their mouth, as I said, over all of this. Anyhow, Edmund, did you have anything from this past week worthy of note?
Just a quick thing. Off of our usual topics and radar, but we do talk about books we're reading sometimes, and I just wanted to mention I recently picked up and have just been finishing up the latest book from Umberto Eco. It was recommended by a friend. It's called Numero Uno, and for an author who has been sort of famous famous for his formidable intellect and erudition throughout his previous volumes. Of course, probably most famous for Name of the Rose, the book, and then the Sean Connery movie that was made of it, about detective monks back in the Middle Ages. But also books like Foucault's Pendulum. But Numero Uno is actually a wonderful little sort of treatise and exploration of journalism and storytelling. It's this guy is recruited to be the editor of a kind of a fictional paper. They are backer wants to bring all these people together and sort of do a test run of what the paper should be. So it in addition to containing some wonderfully digressive stories in terms of what they are actually investigating and writing about. It also has some very fun and coy things to say about the nature of stories and reality and the stories we tell about reality. So if anybody who would usually be intimidated by seeing Echo's name on a book, this is one that is actually much more accessible and a truly delightful read.
Very good, very good. It's always good to get additional options out there for good reading material. I haven't done a whole lot in terms of new reading material in the last few weeks. I guess there was a certain period that I was catching up on things like The Walking Dead and Attack on Titan. My daughter did kind of get me interested in another series called Tokyo Ghoul, which is a bit dark, but doesn't quite have the depth of some of the other things that I typically watch when it comes to anime. But it's got its certain appeal. And I guess when it comes to... I haven't watched the anime yet, but I have been reading the manga, and I'm about, you know, I would say halfway through it. It's got a pretty long run, and it's definitely interesting for so those who like a little bit darker material. That might be something that, you know, might be worthy of looking into. The as far as the American translations go, the first four volumes are translated and out, and they are coming out at a bit faster pace than usual because they're so far behind the Japanese ones. But the Japanese run is still out there somewhere, and of course you might poke around, look for certain stuff. Just saying, you might be able to find it, but anyway. Other than that, I'm really having a hard time getting all the way through the Jim Butcher book, The Aeronauts Windlass. That would be the first book in his steampunk thing. I'm about halfway through, but it's just not quite catching me yet. I'm hoping that I can get to the point where it does. However, in the meantime, I've been trying to catch up on some of the Star Trek novels that have come out, and none have really kind of risen above average in my radar, though, so until they do, I'll just kind of leave that alone. So that's about it for our open topics, I believe, and I guess we can, unless you guys have any last thoughts for this week.
Just really hoping that I don't open up my feeds and see that anyone else has passed away from cancer, just to bring us full circle.
Yes, that would be nice. How about you, Gary?
I just, as I read the descriptions of the shows coming back next week for us, I'm starting to get very anxious to see some of the stuff again, especially, of course, a bunch of the superhero stuff. So, and Agent Carter, too, so we'll see.
Absolutely. And, yeah, I mean, we have quite a lot of good material coming in the next few weeks, and looking forward to all of that. So, that's it for this week. Till next time.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews, and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google Plus under The Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as Fair Use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time, watch, watch, read, read, and listen, and believe in the critical myth.